VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Christina Menenti with your worldwide news update. Israel's defense minister says he has instructed the army to prepare plans for large numbers of Palestinians to leave the Gaza Strip in line with President Donald Trump's proposal for the war-ravaged territory. Israeli leaders have welcomed Trump's proposal, but rights groups say the forcible relocation of a civilian population would amount to ethnic cleansing. The plan also received condemnation from world leaders. Details from VOA's Tommy McNeil.
Defense Minister Israel Katz on Thursday said the plan will include options for exited land crossings as well as special arrangements for exit by sea and air. He said he welcomed U.S. President Donald Trump's bold plan, which could allow a large population in Gaza to leave for various places in the world. He did not say whether Palestinians would be able to one day return to Gaza, which has been rendered largely uninhabitable by Israel's 15-month military campaign against Hamas. Trump on Wednesday proposed that most of Gaza's population be permanently resettled elsewhere while the United States rebuilds the territory. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Officials, meanwhile, said Egypt has launched a diplomatic blitz behind the scenes to try and head off the plan, warning that it could undermine its historic peace treaty with Israel. Foreign Minister Gideon Saar said on Thursday that Israel has informed the United Nations Human Rights Council that it will follow the United States in withdrawing its participation. Officials say a U.S. military contracted plane has crashed in a rice field in the southern Philippines, killing all four people on board. The Civil Aviation Authority of the Philippines confirmed the crash of a light plane in Maguindanao del Sur province. A U.S. embassy spokesperson told the Associated Press the plane that crashed in the southern province was contracted by the U.S. military. A safety official said the bodies of four people who appear to be foreign nationals were retrieved from the wreckage. This is VOA News. According to officials on Thursday, Swedish police found three rifles near the body of the gunman amid a chaotic scene they described as an inferno after 11 people were killed and several wounded in the country's deadliest mass shooting on Tuesday on an educational campus in Örebro. After about an hour, the acute police action stops when the suspected perpetrator is found dead with several weapons next to him. That was Örebro County Police Chief Lars Viren. They believe the suspected killer, identified by a Reuters source and Swedish media as Rickard Andersson, a 35-year-old unemployed recluse, acted alone in the attack and was connected to the adult education center. Police found 10 empty ammunition magazines and a large amount of unused ammunition. Sweden has a high level of gun ownership by European standards, mainly linked to hunting, though it is much lower than in the United States. The wave of gang crime in recent years has also highlighted the high incidence of illegal weapons.
We are, of course, engaging the U.S. government to ensure that the returning deportees are not mistreated in any manner during the flight. At the same time, the House will appreciate that our focus should be on crackdown, strong crackdown on the illegal migration industry.
That was India's foreign minister, who said on Thursday that New Delhi is engaging with the U.S. to ensure that undocumented Indian immigrants are not mistreated while being deported after opposition parties protested against the treatment of a group that was sent back this week. Ankit was one of those deported.
We were handcuffed at the camp, which they call detention center. Our legs and hands were cuffed, including ladies, except the children or those who are below 18 years of age. All of us were shackled. We were given no facilities of washrooms, and they never removed the cuffs, even to eat.
The deportation came a week before Trump is expected to meet Prime Minister Narendra Modi in Washington and sparked a political furor in India, with opposition parties demanding a discussion in Parliament over how the deportees were treated during their return. The Panama Canal Authority on Wednesday denied the U.S. State Department's claim that U.S. government vessels would be able to cross the canal without paying fees, likely ratcheting up tensions after President Donald Trump threatened to take back control of the crossing. Reuters' Julian Satterwaith reports.
The U.S. State Department had made the claim in a social media post, saying it would save millions of dollars per year. But the Panama Canal Authority later responded with a statement to say it had not made any change to fees. Now the denial is likely to ratchet up tensions, with the waterway a key concern for Donald Trump's new administration. He says China has too much influence over the canal, and he's accused Panama of charging excessive rates for U.S. vessels.
Julian Satterwaith for Reuters. Rogers. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The Goma Defense Stadium was full of people singing, welcoming M23. The leader of AFC, Corneille Nangaa, gave a speech.
That was reporter Sabiti Jafar Al-Katanti reporting from Goma on a meeting M23 rebels organized at a stadium. Details coming up also. A Kenyan tech company is using plastic waste to print 3D models that help college students with their learning. And Democrats in the U.S. Congress are protesting over plans to close the U.S. Agency for International Development. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The M23 rebel group had its first public meeting today since seizing the city of Goma after deadly clashes. Reporter Sabiti Jafar Al-Katanti was at the stadium in Goma and briefed me on what went on.
The M23 was in a popular meeting today, which is the first meeting since they took the control of the city of Goma. The Goma Defense Stadium was full of people singing, welcoming M23. The leader of AFC, Corneille Nangaa, gave a speech and got many people. Even now, young people are still registering themselves to join M23 forces in order to continue what they call now the revolution.
So several thousand people actually attended this stadium meeting, and M23 used it as a recruitment mechanism to attract young people to M23. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. I can't be sure with the number. Many people, thousands of people were in the stadium. And when they called for young people to join their forces, many people registered. And there were around 500 young people came to register themselves to join M23 Army.
Jafar, breaking the ceasefire, it had declared unilaterally, M23 seized the South Kivu mining town of Niababwe, which we talked about yesterday when there was fighting. Has Niababwe now under the complete control of M23?
Exactly. The city of Niababwe is under M23 control, and not only Niababwe, they advanced in the night and this morning. They took the control of the city of Nyamukubi and also Bushushu. Nyamukubi is where last year Iran smashed all the houses in the city because flood killed many people. So M23 are in the mountains of Nyamukubi and Bushushu. They have already passed Niabibwe. So Niabibwe, Nyamukubi, Bushushu are now under M23 control. FRDC positions are in the center of Kalehe, a city called Ihus.
And Jafar, is it true that according to humanitarian and local sources that Congolese forces were bracing for an assault in the town of Kavumu, which hosts the province's airport and lies about 30 kilometers from Bukavu?
According to my sources in Kavumu, it's not like that. Forces are in Ihusi, which is the last city of Kalehe territory before starting Kabare territory, and Kavumu is in Kabare territory. But when Flay and some soldiers didn't stop in Urusi, they continued till Kavumu, and they were shot in Gonaya. That's what panicked population, and people thought that fighting reached them in Kavumu. But for now, fighting are a bit far from Kavumu, but I don't know for how long.
And lastly, Jafar, there seems to be so much negative sentiment towards the Tshisekedi government, because according to reports, in the crowd, in the stadium, several people were wearing T-shirts saying governing North Kivu differently. Are people gravitating now towards M23 as opposed to the Kinshasa government?
It's 50-50. I personally talk to many people. Some of them are on the M23 side and others to the government of Kinshasa. But I can say the majority still want the government of Kinshasa, but they want them to negotiate with M23, as people are tired and fed up with the war.
That was reporter Sabiti Jafar Al-Katanti talking with me from Goma. Libyan Prime Minister Abdulhamid Ali Al-Dabiba says opinions are mixed on whether a new U.S. administration under President Donald Trump might shift its approach to Libya's political situation. He added that if the U.S. really wants Libya to be stable, it has to look to more than the security issues. Otherwise, we are going back to square one. Wolfgang Poschtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed this statement with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi.
Well, at first, I think many Libyans need to realize that there are no American vital strategic interests with regard to Libya. There are only important interests with regard to Libya that it doesn't impose a security threat to key partners like Egypt or the Europeans, and to contain the influence of Russia, even with regard to the oil production. Keeping their own American and global resources in mind, the 1.4 million barrel per day that are produced by Libya is only of peripheral interest. Libya is not even among the top 15 producing countries. Therefore, altogether, this does not justify a significant increase of the U.S. engagement in Libya, and we certainly won't see this. The current American support to Libya is more driven by humanitarian assistance, strengthening democratic governance, promoting stability through specific non-security related projects, especially in Fezzan, which is a good approach. And the current only one security related issues for the Americans are the eventual return of ISIS fighters from Syria to Libya, and as I've already said, the Russian military presence. So I don't see any particular initiative from the American side, neither security related nor non-security related.
The Libyan Prime Minister also said there are alternatives that we need to look into, such as reviving our heritage, our economic fabric, and this is precisely what's going to be the building blocks leading to a long-lasting stability in Libya. Is that the best approach to solve the Libyan protracted crisis?
Economic development is a precondition for social stability, and so on. It is not possible to exclude one of these factors, let alone security. But the baby is certainly right. For the Libyans, now there must be also a focus on the economic fabric of the country, which is quite challenging, as the Libyan economy today almost entirely relies on oil and gas. Diversification is required, but threats with oil blockades every other week and fighting between militias even in the capital region make such a diversification in foreign investments very difficult. The current shutdown, as we speak, of the oil crescent terminals by the so-called oil crescent movement is, I would say, very timely, as a new licensing round is planned, and this will certainly not increase the interest of foreign investors. The paper talked about a common heritage. That's a big issue, as Libya was only unified in the early 20th century by the Italian colonizers. So I need to ask, what is the common identity between a Tuareg in the Sahara, a member of the Ibitat tribe on the border to Egypt, and of a citizen in Tripoli? Maybe a regional identity and some kind of federal state might be a solution.
Would the newly appointed UN Special Envoy to Libya be able to change the political landscape in Libya toward a political solution?
all the previous UN special envoys launched initiatives not in coordination with ongoing Libya initiatives. Hopefully the new one, Mrs. Hanna Servatete from Ghana, will talk with the Libyan parliament, the rival parliaments, and all the stakeholders about current Libyan initiatives and analyze them before launching her own. Probably the relatively best chance for success right now has the initiative of the rival parliaments, the HOR and the HCS, based on their 5+5 election laws, albeit controversial, which foresees the appointment of a new prime minister replacing Dabeiba, who is of course against this initiative, and also replacing his eastern rival Osama Hamad. I would say it is very important, even crucial for the new special envoy to realize that there is no compromise between allowing the eastern strongman Khalifa Haftar or Gaddafi's son Saif al-Islam or Prime Minister Dabeiba to run or not to run for presidency. There is no half candidacy. And any referendum, as argued by some, about the current very weak and controversial 2017 draft constitution would delay the elections for several years. So the demands for such a referendum are, I would say, a tool to delay the elections even longer. There is no workaround around these two questions, and it is necessary to face exactly these ones. Ultimately, a regionalization of Libya, a federal state based on an appropriate constitution, is the only way out of this dead-end road. And there is nothing evil with a federation. Even Germany and the United States are federations.
And that was Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Plastic waste accounts for 10 to 12% of all solid waste in Kenya, according to the United Nations Environmental Program. A Kenyan tech company is using plastic waste to print 3D models that help college students with their learning while reducing damage to the environment. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
These 3D models are made from recycled plastic waste. A 3D image is designed and uploaded into a machine, which then prints the desired model. EcoPrints Generation, a company in Mombasa, produces the models. They start with plastic pellets, which are heated at a steady temperature to produce filaments. The filaments are then fed into the 3D printer to produce various models. The demand for these models is growing, especially in the education sector. Diogratius Dalataka is the chief technology officer at EcoPrints Generation.
Most of the people who have needed the use of the filament and the 3D printing products, I've used them to teach and educate learners. It's a visual aid which is better as compared to just drawing a diagram on a blackboard or a whiteboard. And another industry which I've seen is people who do in manufacturing. They tend to test out their prototypes. So that is another use which we've been leveraging on as well.
Kenya generates nearly 1 million metric tons of plastic waste each year, according to the Sustainable Manufacturing and Environmental Pollution Program, which the UN Trade and Development Organization, UNCTAD, helps to implement. Less than 10% of the waste is recycled, with the rest ending in giant trash heaps in the ocean or burned up, releasing harmful emissions into the atmosphere. Jill Industries is one of the few companies in Kenya that recycle plastic. The company processes the waste by breaking it into small pieces, then cleaning and sorting it by color and quality. Some of that plastic is then melted and turned into the pellets used for 3D printing. One of the EcoPrints key customers is Kenya Coast National Polytechnic, a college in Mombasa. Architectural students there use 3D models made from recycled plastic to showcase house structures and surrounding features like trees, cars and people. These 3D models have made teaching easier for lecturers and improved students' understanding of their coursework. Haida Omar is a student at the college.
The 3D models, it has really helped us, as every time it comes in exam, it is really easy for you to remember what to do and what you have been taught by the teacher.
Langat Philemon is an architectural engineering lecturer at the school.
These 3D models has helped in creating the realities of what is done theoretically in class. During the demonstration, it helps now in creating the reality. We can see the realities of cars, of landscapes, that is there for trees, for persons, people who are living in a particular building when we do our design.
As education and teaching methods change, these young innovators see a chance to grow their business by using plastic waste to benefit students, the environment and their communities. For now, EcoPrint Generation prints only small and medium-sized objects, but they have ambitions to print bigger ones, such as a house that architecture students can use for their studies. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Mombasa, Kenya.
Niger's ruling military government says an ambush killed at least 10 Nigerian soldiers near the country's border with Burkina Faso this week, where authorities have been battling a jihadist insurgency. A military statement said Wednesday, an intervention unit was sent to the west of the country on Monday to catch criminals stealing cattle when they were ambushed. The attackers managed to flee, but the military caught and neutralized 15 of them on Tuesday. Niger, along with its neighbors Burkina Faso and Mali, has for over a decade battled an insurgency fought by Islamist militant groups, including some allied with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group. Following military coups in all three nations, the military governments have expelled French forces and turned to Russia's mercenary units for security assistance. But regional analysts say the security situation in the Sahel, a vast region on the fringes of the Sahara Desert, has gotten worse. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202-258-3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. The United States said yesterday it was making an exemption in President Donald Trump's aid freeze to support a security mission in troubled Haiti, although some assistance was put on hold. The announcement came as Secretary of State Marco Rubio visited the neighboring Dominican Republic. The French news agency AFP reports, a State Department spokesperson said, Rubio approved $40.7 million in foreign assistance to benefit the Haitian National Police and the Multinational Security Support Mission. Kenyan police make up much of the international force, which is trying to contain the violent gangs that control much of Haiti and stabilize the country. The State Department spokesman said the U.S. has not paused all assistance. The United Nations has said on Tuesday the U.S. had notified that it was pausing a contribution of $13.3 million in aid. The State Department did not deny the pause, but said it was a fraction of the total U.S. contribution. Congressional Democratic leadership warned President Donald Trump this week they will use upcoming government funding talks as leverage to fight the administration's changes at the U.S. government agencies such as the U.S. Agency for International Development, the nation's lead provider of humanitarian aid overseas. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Jepson has more.
From protecting Amazon rainforests to caring for Myanmar refugees and housing Ukrainians fleeing the war against Russia, the absence of U.S. assistance is being felt around the world. In Washington this week, Democratic lawmakers protested outside the now closed headquarters of the lead U.S. aid agency and outside the U.S. Capitol. Cory Booker is a Democratic senator.
We will fight their violations of separation of powers. We will fight their violations of our Constitution of the United States of America. We will not shut up. We will stand up. We will speak up. We will rise up.
Earlier this week, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, was moved under the control of Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and almost all its employees put on leave, following an executive order from President Donald Trump freezing U.S. foreign assistance pending review. Jonathan Jackson is a Democratic congressman.
Now we're seeing the most powerful man in the world, Donald J. Trump, and we're seeing the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, now take money and food from the poorest woman and the poorest man on earth.
Congressional Republicans say Trump is exercising broad presidential authority to reevaluate government agencies. Trump is accomplishing this through Elon Musk, a multi-billionaire whom he put in charge of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, whose aim is to reduce federal spending. John Thune is Senate Majority Leader.
I don't think they're closing an agency, but I do think they have the right to review funding and how those decisions are made and what priorities are being funded. I think that's probably true of any administration when they come in. There are lots of programs authorized and funded through that agency, some of which I think are operating in the way in which they were intended, some which aren't.
One analyst told VOA the situation is unprecedented in the United States. Claire Finkelstein is a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania.
Arguably, it's a real violation of separation of powers for the executive branch to try to shut down agencies completely that Congress has brought into existence and that Congress endows and appropriates funds for, even if the executive branch has quite a lot of discretion with regard to how to operationalize those funds and how the agency is going to function.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Tuesday he's supportive of efforts to eliminate fraud and abuse, but criticized the speed and secrecy of the process.
Whatever DOGE is doing, it's not democracy. We know what democracy's like. It's out in the open, it's not secret.
Democrats have pledged to stall votes on Trump's cabinet nominees and leverage their votes on a new government spending bill to protest the changes at USAID. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The United Nations warned Thursday that two southern Sudan states were on the brink of catastrophe after a recent eruption of violence. Renewed fighting broke out last week in the states of South Kordofan and Blue Nile between the army and a faction of the Sudan's People's Liberation Movement North, or SPLMN, led by Abdel Aziz Al-Hilu. United Nations resident and humanitarian coordinator in Sudan, Clementine Nikwita Salame, said the fighting reportedly had claimed at least 80 lives in the southern Kordofan state capital, Kadiguli, alone. Sudan's army and its main rival, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, have been at war for control of the country since April 2023. The fighting has killed tens of thousands of civilians, uprooted 12 million people, and pushed nearly 26 million into acute food insecurity. Hilu's unaffiliated faction of the SPLMN has clashed with both since the war broke out. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast comes to you at the top of each hour